Track 15.
The branches that screened the entrance to the tunnel parted, and Yasmini stepped out into the moonlight. She wore a simple white robe and a cloth over her head. He saw at once that she had grown inches taller, but her body was still slim and supple as a vine, her step quick and alert as a frightened gazelle. She saw him and stopped dead, then slowly reached up and drew aside the veil that covered her face. He gasped. In the moonlight she was beautiful. Although no longer a child, her face was delicate and still elfin in quality, with high cheekbones and huge dark eyes. When she smiled, her lips were full, her teeth white and even. He stood up and pulled back his own veil. She started. "You have grown so tall. And the beard?" She broke off and stood, uncertain. "And you have grown into a lovely woman." "Oh, I have missed you so," she whispered. "Every single day." Suddenly she ran to him, and he held out his arms. She was trembling and sobbing softly against his chest. "Don't cry, Yasi. Please, don't cry." "I am so happy," she sobbed. "I have never been so happy in all my life." He drew her down on the coral block, and she stopped weeping, pulled back at arm's length to gaze into her face. "I have heard news of you even in the Zanana, how you have become a mighty warrior, how you won a great fight in the desert, and rode with our father to Muscat, and won another fierce battle there." "Not single-handed," he smiled and traced the line of her mouth with his fingertip. They talked quickly and eagerly, breaking in upon each other and leaving much only half said before flitting on to another idea. "What happened to your pet monkey, Ginny?" he asked. Tears welled up into her eyes, sparkling in the moonlight. "Ginny is dead," she whispered. "Kush found him in his precious garden and beat him to death with a spade. He sent his little body to me as a gift." Dorian changed the subject then, distracting her with other more pleasant childhood memories, and soon she was laughing again. Then they both fell silent, and she lowered her eyes shyly. Without looking at him, she whispered, "Do you remember how you took me to swim in the sea when we were children? That was the first time I ever remember leaving the Zenana." "I remember." His voice was gruff. "Will you take me again tonight?" She looked up at him. "Please, Dowie." They went down through the trees hand in hand and found the beach deserted and glistening in the moonlight. The shadows of the palms were purple-black on the sands, and the water shone with the oily luminescence of a black pearl. Since last they had been here, the cave in the sandstone had been excavated deeper by the wave action of the high tides. They paused at the entrance and turned to each other. "Is what we are doing a sin?" she asked him. "If it is, I do not care," he replied. "I know only that I love you, and that being with you does not feel to me like a sin." "I love you also," she said. "I could not love anyone or anything more, though I live 100 years. She untied the ribbon at her neck and let her shift drop onto the sand. She wore only pantaloons of silk. Dorian could not breathe as he gazed at her. Her breasts had swelled, and the tips were dark and pointed. Her skin was smooth and gleamed, like the lining of an oyster shell. "You used to tease me that I looked like a monkey," she said, half defiant and half timid, fearing his rejection. "Not any more." He had caught his breath. "I have never seen anything more beautiful. I was so afraid I would not please you. I want you to like me, Dowie. Tell me that you like me, please." "I love you," he said. "I want you to be my woman and my wife." She laughed with joy, took his hands and placed them on her breasts. They were warm and pliant, and the nipples hardened as he rolled them gently between his fingers. "I am your woman. I think I have always been your woman. I do not know how it is done, but I want to be your wife here tonight." "Are you sure, my darling?" If others learned of this, it could mean disgrace and a terrible death. To be without you would be a death far worse than anything that even Kush could contrive. I know that it cannot be forever. But give me this one night to be your wife. Show me how, Dowie, please, show me how. So he spread his robes on the sand, and laid her down upon them, and slowly, with infinite gentleness, small sounds of love and wonder, gasps of surprise, and, in the end, a single long, shuddering spasm of pain that was soon lost in the transport of joy that followed. They became lovers. Over the days that followed, Dorian was embroiled in the planning of his coming campaign on the mainland across the Channel. He purchased most of the draft animals and horses that were available on Lamu and sent one of his captains with three dhows south to Zanzibar to do the same thing there. He also bought up much of the available grain stocks and trade goods in the markets. Then he spent hours each day talking to the caravan masters and the Arab traders who had been in the caravans the marauders had attacked and looted. He tried to find out the identity of the bandits, their numbers, how they were armed, and the methods they used to carry out the attacks. He tallied the losses these men had suffered, and the totals shocked him. Over 3 lakhs of gold dust had been stolen, over 27 tons of new ivory and almost 15,000 freshly captured slaves. The caliph had every reason to be worried. As to the marauders themselves, the reports were vague and contradictory. Some said they were white men, Franks, with black archers and spearmen. Others said that they were but savages who fought with spear and arrow. One said that they carried out their raids only during the night when the caravans were encamped. Another told how they ambushed his long files of slaves and porters during the day and murdered all the Arab escorts, and that he alone escaped. Another merchant told how they had spared him and all his men and set them free after stripping them of all their possessions. Dorian realized that there was no agreement as to who they were and no clear pattern as to their methods. Only one thing was clear. The marauders appeared like forest djinns out of the southern wilderness and disappeared back the same way. "What do they do with the slaves they capture?" he asked, and the Arabs shrugged. "They must sell them somewhere," he insisted. "They would need a fleet of large ships to transport such numbers." "There has been no sighting of such a fleet along the Fever Coast," they told him, and Dorian's puzzlement increased. He had so little certain information on which he could base his plans. All he could concentrate on was protecting the caravans and getting them moving again, for the trade had almost dried up. Faced with such heavy losses, few of the Arab merchants on Lamu and Zanzibar would take the risk of financing further expeditions. His other planning revolved around taking the war to the bandits, following them into their fastnesses, tracking them down like the wild animals they were, and destroying them. For this purpose, he recruited all the scouts and caravan guides who had been left idle by the cessation of the trade. He could not begin the campaign until the weather on the mainland changed, for this was the season of the big wet, when the coastal lowlands were inundated with the rains and the Fever Coast lived up to its fearsome reputation. However, he must be ready to sail as soon as the rain ceased and the Kuzi wind started to blow again. Thinking of the start of the Kuzi always brought his mind back to Yasmini. That same wind would carry her ship north to the Gulf and her marriage. The thought made his gut sour with anger and frustration. He thought of writing to the caliph in Muscat and asking him to cancel the marriage plans. He even considered confessing his love to his adoptive father and asking him for dispensation to marry Yasmini. They met each evening after dark. But when he broached this idea to her, Yasmini was terrified and trembled with fear. "I think not about myself, Dowie, but if our father even suspects that there is the love of a man and a woman between us, no matter how much he loves you, he will be honour-bound to place your case before the mullahs to be judged by the Sharia laws. There could be only one verdict for both of us. No, Dowie, there is no escape that way. Our destiny is with God, and he is not always merciful." "I will take you away," Dorian declared. "We will take one of the dhows and a few of my best men and sail away, find some place where we can live out our love." "There is no such place. Yasmini told him sadly. We are both of Islam, and there would be no place in Islam for us. We would be outcasts and wanderers forever. Here you are a great man, soon to be greater. You have the love and respect of our father and of all men. I will not let you throw all that away for me. They spent much of their precious time together discussing their terrible predicament. They lay in each other's arms in the moonlight and whispered endlessly. When they saw that there was no escape or release for them, they made love with an almost savage passion, as though to divert the fate that loomed before them. Before dawn each morning, Dorian led her back to the entrance tunnel, where she kissed him as if for the last time and took the angel's road back into the Zenana. During the days, the girl who had once been playful and happy, loved by all the Zenana, was now pale, silent, and lethargic. Her friends and all the servants gradually became alarmed. And there was nothing that happened in that little enclosed world that did not come at last to the ears of Kush. Their flawed idyll of love and desperation lasted through the months leading up to the change of the monsoon winds. The expeditionary force to the mainland was almost ready to sail, and the final preparations for Yasmini's wedding were complete. Her dowry had been sent from Muscat to her bridegroom in Abu Dhabi. Her trousseau was packed and ready to go aboard the dhow that would carry her away to her new home thousands of miles to the north and the confines of another royal Zenana in which she would pass the rest of her life. "I cannot let this happen," Dorian told her. "I will rescue you from that, even if I have to forsake everything in this life." "No, Dowie, I will not let you do it. You will have many other wives in the years ahead, and you will win glory and happiness without me." "No," he said, "I do not care about the rest. I care only for you." "Then I can never come out to you again along the Angel's Road, unless you promise me to put this madness out of your mind. This will be the last time we will meet, Dowie. You must swear to me." "I cannot do that." "Then I will never see you again." He saw that she was determined. "Please, Yasi, you cannot be so cruel to both of us. Then make love to me for the last time." "Yasi, I cannot go on without you. You are strong. You will go on. Make love to me. Give me something to hold on to remember through the years ahead." So they parted at the entrance to the tunnel. And Yasmini ran back through the narrow passage, blinded with her tears. As she clambered out of the opening above the tomb of the saint, a huge hand closed on her arm and lifted her off her feet. As she struggled and kicked, Kush giggled into her face, holding her easily. "I have waited many years for this, my little harlot. I knew that one day you would place yourself in my power. You were always too bold and headstrong." "Leave me!" she screamed. "Put me down!" "No," Kush replied. "Now you are mine. Never again will you flout my rules. The other women will listen to your screams and they will quail in their beds and think about the price of sin." "My father," she cried, "my future husband, they will make you pay dearly if you harm me." "Your father barely knows your name. He has many other daughters and none of them is a whore. Your future husband would never accept rotten, half-chewed fruit into his Zenana. No, my little one, from now on you belong to Kush alone." Kush carried her to the little cell beside the cemetery in the rear of the gardens, screened from the rest of the Zenana by a hedge of flowering thorns. Two of his assistants were waiting there, eunuchs also, big men, gaunt to fat, but powerful. They had performed this punishment many times before, and they had made all the preparations. Kush laid Yasmini on the hard wooden frame and carefully took off her clothing. All three were grinning with anticipation, stripped to loincloths, but already sweating in the small hot cell. They touched her body as it was revealed, stroking her smooth limbs, sniffing her hair, pinching her small glossy breasts. Then, when she was naked, they strapped her wrists and ankles with leather thongs until she lay spread-eagled and pinioned. Then Kush stood between her legs and smiled down at her in an almost avuncular fashion.
You have been taken in harlotry. We know the man. But it spites me that he has grown too powerful to bring to justice. His punishment will be to hear of your fate. The rest of the world beyond these walls will hear that you died of a fever. Many do at this season of the year. However, I will make certain that your lover has the truth whispered in his ear. For the rest of his life he will live with the knowledge that he was responsible for your strange particular death.
Still smiling, he leaned forward and placed his fat hand on her private parts, gently stroking the soft nest of fine dark hair between her thighs.
I am sure you have heard what happens to all the bad girls who have come to this room. But in case you are uncertain, I will explain it to you as we go along.
He nodded to one of the other eunuchs, who came to stand beside Kush, holding a wooden tray. On it lay two small packets. They were wrapped in fine rice paper, fish-shaped, as long as a finger and tapered at both ends. They gleamed in the lamplight, for they were heavily greased with sheep fat.
These each contain 5 ounces of chili powder. I grow the pods myself in my little garden. They are the fiercest variety. The juice from my fruit will burn the skin and flesh from the mouth of a mogul, fed all his life on the strongest curries. I have to wear gloves of dogskin to protect my hands when I grind the powder.
Suddenly he thrust his fat forefinger deep into her.
One for this pretty perfumed little hole in front, he grinned down at her, as she screamed with shock, pain, and humiliation.
Then he pulled out his finger and thrust it in again further back.
And the second packet for this other, darker cavern at the rear.
He withdrew his finger, sniffed it, wrinkled his nose, and pulled a face at the other two eunuchs. They tittered with delight. He picked up one of the packets from the tray. Yasmini stared at it in horror and struggled against her bonds.
"Hold her legs," he grunted at the other two.
One of them forced her knees as far apart as they would go. Kush spread the silky fur and the soft lips beyond. Then, with the expertise bred of practice, he slipped the greased packet into her body.
"See how Al-Amkhara has opened the way for me and made my task easier," he said,
then stood back and wiped his fingers on his loincloth.
"The front end done. Now for the rear," he said,
and picked up the other packet. His assistant reached under Yasmini's body and took one of her small round buttocks in each hand and drew them rudely apart. She was gnawing her lips and her teeth were stained pink with her own blood. She whipped her lithe golden body back and forth as far as her bonds would allow, and tears ran back into her hair. With his free hand, Kush groped between her buttocks.
"Open it wider," he told the other man. "Yes, that's better. So sweet and tight."
Yasmini's sobs ended with a sharp, high squeal.
"Ah, yes," Kush gloated. "That's it. All the way. As far as I can reach."
He stepped back.
"Shabash! It is done. Bind her ankles and her knees together so that she cannot expel the sweetmeats."
They worked swiftly, then stood back and surveyed their handiwork with satisfaction.
"Now go out and finish digging the whore's grave."
They went out into the cemetery, and soon there came the sound of their spades biting into the sandy earth, their jovial banter as they worked. Kush came to Yasmini's side.
"Your bier is ready, and the sheet to cover you when we lower you into the earth."
He pointed them out to her against the far wall.
"And see, I have even carved your headboard with my own loving hands."
He held it up for her to read.
"It has the date of your death, and tells the world that you died of fever."
Yasmini was silent now, her body rigid. Her eyes, wide and glittering with tears, were fastened on his face as he bent over her.
"You see, the chili powder is so virulent that it will eat its way through the rice paper, while from the outside the juices of your own body will moisten and weaken it further. Soon the packet will dissolve, and the powder will be released into your secret places.
He stroked her hair back from her forehead, then with his thumb wiped the tears from her eyelids with feminine gentleness.
At first you will feel a tiny stinging which will grow into a fire. A raging fire that will make you long for the lesser heat of hell. I have watched many whores die upon this wooden bed, but I do not think there are words to describe their suffering. It will eat out your womb and your bowels like 100 rats burrowing into your softness, and your screams will carry to every woman in the Zenana. They will remember you when next they are tempted to sin.
He was breathing heavily now, and his expression was rapt, deeply aroused by the picture of suffering he was painting.
"When will it begin?" he asked rhetorically. "We cannot be sure. In an hour or two, or even longer. There is no way of telling. How long will it last? I cannot tell you. I have seen the weak ones die in a day, and the strong ones last 4 days, screaming to the end. I think you are one of the strong ones. But we will see."
He went to the doorway and called to the men who were digging the grave.
"Are you not finished yet? You cannot come and watch the fun until you are finished."
"Soon."
One paused and leaned on his spade. Only the top of his shaved head was visible above the rim of the excavation.
"We will be finished before the first packet bursts open."
Cush went back into the hut and settled his bulk comfortably on the bench against the far wall.
"The waiting is the interesting part," he told Yasmini. "Some beg for mercy. But I know you are too proud for that. Sometimes the brave ones try to conceal from me the moment when the paper breaks open. They try to deny me my enjoyment. But not for long," he giggled. "Not for very long."
He folded his arms across his soft, womanly breasts and leaned back against the wall.
"I will be beside you to the end, Yasmini, to share each exquisite moment with you. And I shall probably shed a tear at your graveside, for I am a man of sentiment and soft-hearted."
The word that Cush had taken another girl to the little hut beside the graveyard spread swiftly through the Zenana, and the instant that Tahi heard the rumour, she knew with dreadful certainty who the girl was. She also knew exactly what she must do. She did not hesitate, but threw on a shawl and veil and picked up the basket in which she always brought back her purchases from the town when she was sent on errands by one of the royal wives or concubines. As an ancient free woman, she could pass without check between the Zenana and the open world beyond the walls, and among her duties was the daily trip into the markets. She left her dingy room at the rear of the kitchen block and hurried along the cloisters. She was terrified that one of the eunuchs would stop her before she reached the gates. A deep, unnatural silence hung like a pall over the Zenana, and the gardens and the cloisters were deserted. No child laughed, no woman sang, and the fires in the kitchen were dead and cold. Every inhabitant of the woman's world had locked herself and her offspring in her own quarters. It was so quiet that when Tahi stopped to listen, all she could hear was her own blood pulsing in her ears. Only one of the eunuch guards was on the gate, but he knew her well. He was so distracted by the hushed air of drama that he hardly glanced at her face as she drew back her veil to identify herself. He waved her through with one pudgy, beringed hand. The moment she was out of sight of the gate, she flung away the basket and broke into a heavy run. Within a mile, her heart felt so swollen with fatigue that she could hardly breathe. She fell on the verge of the track and could not force her legs to carry her another step. A slave boy came out of the fields, driving two donkeys ahead of him, laden with bundles of mangrove bark for tanning leather. Tahi staggered to her feet and hunted under her robes for her purse.
"My daughter is dying," he called to the boy. "I must fetch the doctor to her." She held up a silver rupee. "Take me to him, and there will be another coin for you when we arrive at the fort."
The lad ogled the coin, then nodded vigorously. He untied one of the bundles of bark and let it fall on the verge. He boosted Tahi onto the donkey's back, then whipped the little animal into a trot and ran behind it, laughing and calling to Tahi,
"Hold on tight, old mother. Rabat is as swift as an arrow. We will have you at the port before you have time to blink twice."
Dorian sat on the terrace with Ben Abram at his side. They were drinking cups of black tarry coffee and were engrossed in compiling a list of the medical supplies that would be needed by the expedition to the mainland. The pair had joyously renewed their friendship at almost the same minute that Dorian had stepped ashore on the beach at Lamu. Every day, Ben Abram had come to join him in the morning prayers, and afterwards they sat long together in the pleasant, easy conversation of old friends. "I am too old to leave the island," Ben Abraham was protesting at Dorian's insistence that he join the expedition to care for the health of the soldiers. "We both know that you are as strong and as spry as the first day we met," Dorian told him. "Would you let me die of some horrible disease in the interior? I need you, Ben Abraham." Dorian broke off as he heard a commotion at the end of the terrace. He stood up and shouted irritably at the guards, "What is this uproar? You have my strict orders that I am not to be disturbed." "I am as dust under your feet, great sheikh, but there is an old crone here who kicks and scratches like a rabid wildcat," Dorian exclaimed with annoyance, and was about to order them to send the woman off with a swat across her buttocks when she screeched, "Al Amhara! It is me, Tahi! In the name of Allah, let me speak to you of someone we both love." Dorian went cold with dread. Tahi would never have been so indiscreet unless some terrible disaster had overtaken Yasmini. "Let her pass," he shouted to the guards, and hurried to meet the old woman as she tottered down the terrace, far gone with fatigue and worry. She collapsed at his feet and clung to his knees. "Kush knows about you and the girl. He was waiting for Yasmini as she came back to the Zenana, and he has taken her to the little room beside the graveyard," she blurted out. From his own sojourn behind the Zenana walls, Dorian knew about the little room. Although it was strictly forbidden, the small boys of the Zenana had dared each other to creep beyond the thorn hedge and go into it to touch the dreadful wooden frame. They terrified each other with horror stories of what Kush did to the women he took there. One of the most chilling memories of all Dorian's days within the Zenana were the shrieks of a girl named Salima, who had been taken there after Kush had discovered her love for a young officer of the governor's guard. Those cries had lasted 4 days and 3 nights, growing slowly weaker all that time, and the silence at the end was more harrowing than the shrillest scream had been. For long moments he was unmanned by Tahi's warning. He felt the strength go out of his legs so that he could not move them, and his mind went blank, as though trying to hide from the horror of it. Then, with a shudder, he threw off his weakness and turned to Ben Abram. The old doctor came to his feet. His expression was filled with alarm, tempered with compassion. "I should not have heard those words, my son. You must have been foolish, mad, beyond any reason. But my heart breaks for you." "Help me, old friend," Dorian pleaded. "Yes, I have been foolish, and I have committed a terrible sin, but it was the sin of love. You know what Kush will do to her." Ben Abraham nodded. "I have seen the fruits of his monstrous cruelty. Ben Abraham, I need your help." By the sheer intensity of his gaze, Dorian tried to will him to it. "I cannot enter the Zenana," the old man said. "If I bring her out to you, will you help us?" "Yes, my son. If you can bring her out to me, I will help you, if it is not too late." Ben Abram turned to Tahi. "When did he take her to the little room?"
"I know not. Perhaps 2 hours ago," Tahi sobbed.
"Well, then we have very little time," said Ben Abram briskly. "I have the instruments I need with me. We can go at once."
"You will never be able to keep pace with me, old father," Dorian strapped on his sword belt. "Come after me as fast as you can ride. There is a secret way under the walls on the east side." Swiftly he described how to find the entrance to the tunnel.
"I have ridden past there and remember the old ruins," Ben Abram murmured.
"Wait for me there,"
Dorian said, then raced down the staircase 3 steps at a time and into the courtyard. As he ran to the stables, he saw that one of the grooms was leading out his black stallion to curry it in the yard. The horse had a halter on its lean Arabian head, and was one of the fleetest in Dorian's string of fine animals that the Caliph had pressed on him as a parting gift when he left Muscat. He snatched the single rein out of the startled groom's hand and vaulted onto the stallion's bare back. As he hammered his heels into the horse's flanks, the stallion jumped away, and before they reached the gates of the fort, he was at full gallop. They raced through the narrow streets, scattering chickens, dogs, and terrified people from their path. As they burst out of the narrow lanes into the open country, Dorian lay flat along the stallion's neck and pushed him to the top of his speed. "Go!" he whispered in his ear. And the stallion flicked back his ears to listen. "Run for the very life of my love!" There was a shortcut through the mangroves. Dorian turned the horse off the main road, and they splashed through the mud for 100 yards until they hit firm ground again, then sped through the palm grove on the far side, saving almost half a mile. The high walls of the Zenana were white through the boles of the palms, and he sheered off towards the beach to keep out of sight of the gate. Once he was clear, he swung back again and galloped along the base of the wall. He saw the mound of ruins just ahead, and leapt down with one arm around the stallion's neck, his feet skimming the earth. He let go before the horse had stopped, and used the momentum to hurl himself up the side of the tumbled ruins and down into the saucer beyond. He dragged aside the trailing branches and ran into the dark opening. The interior was narrower and lower than he remembered it, and it was pitch dark. When the uneven floor started to rise under his feet, he almost fell. At last he saw ahead the dim light from the exit hole and could go on even faster. He jumped up, caught the rim of the opening, and with a single movement heaved himself through and out onto the sunlit terrace where long ago Yasmini and her little friends had played with their dolls. It was deserted. He crossed it with long strides and dropped down the staircase on which Zayn al-Din had injured his ankle into the garden below. At the bottom, he paused to take his bearings. A pall of silence hung over the Zenana and the gardens. None of the female slaves tended the flower beds and fountains. No person moved, and there was no birdsong. In the hush, the very breeze had dropped, as though all nature held its breath. The palm fronds drooped silently, and not a leaf stirred on the high tops of the casuarina trees. He drew his sword, knowing that he would kill without hesitation any of the eunuchs who tried to stop him, and went towards the north end of the enclosure, towards the mosque and the cemetery. He ran down the narrow lane between the outer wall and behind the mosque. Ahead was the thorn hedge that surrounded the cemetery. He ducked through the well-remembered gap and looked across the burial ground. Each grave mound had a headboard set above it, and some of the newer graves were still decorated with faded ribbons and flags. The hut was on the far side, and the thorn hedge had almost overgrown and smothered it in the years since he had last seen it. The door was open, and Dorian held his breath as he listened for any sound of suffering coming from the interior. The quiet was suffocating and ominous, seemingly charged with evil. Then he heard voices, the high feminine chatter of a castrated man. He hid the sword under a fold of his robe and slipped forward silently. There was a gust of giggles, and he saw one of the eunuchs sitting on the edge of the newly dug grave, his feet swinging in the hole, the rolls of his belly fat hanging into his lap. Dorian stepped up behind him. He could see the knuckles of his spine through the fat as the man leaned forward to speak to somebody in the pit beneath him. Dorian drove the needle point of the long curved blade of his scimitar through the joint between two vertebrae, separating the spinal cord with a surgeon's stroke. The eunuch died without a murmur, collapsed and slid into the hole, his weight pulling him off the blade. He fell like a sack of lard on the man beneath him. Trapped under his weight, the other man squealed with outrage and struggled to free himself. "What are you doing, Sharif? Have you gone mad? Get off me!" He pushed off the corpse and rose to his feet. The top of his head was just below ground level, and he was still peering down at the dead man lying at his feet. "Get up, Sharif! What game are you playing?" The top of his shaven head looked like an ostrich egg. Dorian raised the sword, then slashed down, splitting his skull neatly in half down to the level of his teeth. With a twist of his wrist, he levered the blade from the crisp bone of the skull and turned to the door of the hut. He ran to it, and as he reached it, Kush appeared before him, blocking the door with his huge bulk. They stared at each other for only a fleeting moment, but Kush recognized him. He had been among the crowd on the beach when Dorian had stepped ashore on his arrival with the flotilla from Muscat. With astonishing speed and agility for such a gross creature, he leapt back into the room and snatched up a spade that stood against the wall. With another leap, he put the heavy wooden frame on which Yasmini was stretched out between him and Dorian and raised the spade high over the girl.
"Stay back!" he screamed. "With a single blow, I can burst the bags inside her and release the poison."
Yasmini lay naked under his threat, her long, slim legs trussed tightly together at ankle and knee, and her arms stretched out over her head, pulling her tender golden breasts out of shape. She looked up at Dorian, but even her huge eyes were not large or deep enough to contain all her terror. Dorian launched himself across the room just as Kush started to bring down the blade with all his strength behind it. Dorian came in under the blow before it struck Yasmini in her tender midriff, spreading his body over hers, shielding her. The spade struck his back, and he felt his ribs crack. Pain flared through his chest. He rolled over the frame, forcing himself to ignore the pain, careful not to place his weight on her body and break the fragile sacks. Kush lifted the spade again, and this time aimed at Dorian's head. His fat face was a mask of fury, and his great belly bulged forward over his loincloth. Dorian's whole left side was numb from the blow, and he was down on one knee, unable to rise in time to meet the next. He still had the sword in his right hand. He reached out with the blade and drew the edge across Kush's belly from side to side at the level of his navel, opening him up the way a fishwife splits the stomach of a grouper. Kush dropped the spade, which clattered onto the stone floor. He reeled back against the far wall and with both hands tried to hold the lips of the long wound closed. He stared down at it with an air of astonishment and watched his own entrails bulge out between his fingers in slippery ropes. The hot, fetid stink of his ruptured gut filled the little room. Dorian dragged himself to his feet. His left arm dangled at his side, numb and useless, and he leaned over Yasmini.
"I prayed that you would come," she whispered. "I did not think it was possible, and now it is too late. Kush has put terrible things inside me."
"I know what he has done," Dorian told her. "Don't talk. Lie still."
Kush gave a high, keening cry, but Dorian barely glanced at him as he slumped forward on his face, then kicked and struggled weakly in the mess of his own guts. Dorian slipped the blade of his scimitar between Yasmini's ankles and cut the leather thongs. Then he did the same for those at her knees.
"Don't try to sit up. Any contraction might burst the bags."
With a touch of the razor edge, he cut the bonds that held her wrists, then dropped the sword and massaged his paralyzed left arm. With a surge of relief, he felt it begin to tingle, and the strength flowing down it to his fingertips. He slipped his arm under Yasmini's shoulders, lifted her carefully off the wooden frame, and set her on her feet.
"Squat," he ordered. "Slowly. Make no sudden movement."
He held her down.
"Now spread your knees apart and push gently, as though you were at stool."
He knelt down beside her and placed his arm around her shoulders.
"Gently to begin with, then harder."
She took a deep breath and bore down, her face contorted and darkened with blood. There was a sudden spluttering sound, and one of the packets was driven out of her body with such force that it hit the floor between her feet and burst open, spilling the red powder across the flagstones. The acrid chemical smell of chili mingled with the stink of Kush's feces and stung their nostrils.
"Good. Well done, Yassi." He held her tighter.
"Can you do the same with the other sack?"
"I will try."
She took another breath and strained again. But after a minute she gave a sharp sigh and shook her head.
"No, it will not move. I can't do it."
"Then Abram is waiting at the end of the Angel's Road," he said. "I am taking you to him. He will know what to do." Gently he lifted her to her feet. "You must not try to walk. The least movement might burst the bag. Slowly now, put one arm around my neck. Hold on." He slipped his good arm under her knees and lifted her easily. As he strode to the door, Cush was moaning and blubbering.
"Help me! Don't leave me! I am dying!"
Dorian did not look back. He skirted the open grave in the bottom of which lay the two dead eunuchs. He went quickly, dreading meeting another, for he had left his scimitar on the floor of the hut, and he did not yet have full use of his injured arm. Much more, he dreaded jolting or squeezing Yasmini. He had to try to balance speed against caution, and he whispered soft reassurance to her as he went, trying to calm and comfort her. "It'll be all right, my little one. Ben Abram will be able to rid you of it. It will soon be over." He crossed the lawns with a smooth stride that cushioned his precious burden, and he climbed the staircase to the terrace of the saint's tomb one step at a time, treading lightly. He lowered her through the opening into the tunnel, and when he scrambled down beside her, he peered anxiously into her face for any sign that the movement had triggered something unspeakable within her tender womanhood. "Are you all right?" he asked. She nodded and tried to smile. "We are nearly there now. Ben Abram is waiting." He lifted her again and had to bend almost double to clear the low roof as he started down the tunnel. He saw the light ahead and almost involuntarily took a longer step. A fragment of loose coral rolled under his foot and he stumbled and almost fell, bumping her into the wall. "Ah!" Yasmini gasped as she was jolted, and Dorian felt his heart constrict. "What is it, my darling?" "It stings inside me," she whispered. "Oh, Allah, it burns." He ran the last few paces and carried her out into the sunlit saucer among the ruins. "Ben Abram," Dorian shouted. "In God's name, where are you?"
"Here, my son."
Ben Abram stood up from where he had been waiting in the shade and hurried to them, lugging his bag.
"It has begun, old father. Make haste."
They laid her on the ground, and Dorian gasped out an almost incoherent explanation of how Yasmini had rid herself of one packet. "But the other is still inside her, and it has begun to leak." "Hold her knees up like this," Ben Abram said, and then to Yasmini, "I am going to hurt you. These are the instruments I use in childbirth." They glittered in his hands. She closed her eyes.
"I submit myself to the will of God," she murmured, and dug her fingernails into Dorian's forearm as Ben Abram went to work.
The evidence of her pain rippled across her lovely face and tightened and twisted her lips. Once she made a small mewing sound, and Dorian whispered helplessly,
"I love you, flower of my heart." "I love you, Dowie," she gasped, "but there is a burning fire inside me."
"I am going to cut you now," Ben Abram said. A moment later, Yasmini cried out, and her whole body stiffened. Dorian looked down and saw blood on Ben Abram's hands as he took up a silver instrument shaped like a double spoon. A minute later, he sat back on his heels with the blood-smeared, sodden, half-disintegrated packet captured between the spoons.
"I have it," he said, "but it has leaked the spice into her. We must get her down to the water quickly."
Dorian snatched her up, his injured arm and the pain of his cracked ribs forgotten. He ran with Yasmini's naked body clutched to his chest. Ben Abram hobbled along behind them, losing distance as Dorian tore away between the palm trees. He ran down the beach and into the ocean, plunging Yasmini into the cool green water. Ben Abram came in after them with a brass enema syringe in his hand. Dorian held Yasmini's lower body beneath the surface, while Ben Abram repeatedly filled the tube of the syringe with seawater and forced it into her. It was almost half an hour before he was satisfied and allowed Dorian to carry her out of the water and up the beach. She was trembling with shock and pain. Dorian wrapped her in his woolen shawl, and they laid her in a shaded place under the trees. Ben Abram took a large bottle of salve from his bag and anointed her injuries. After a while, her shivering abated, and she told them, "The pain is passing now. It still burns, but not as badly." "I was able to remove most of the poison in the spoons. I think I managed to flush out the rest before it did much damage. I had to cut you to reach the sack, but it is a clean cut, and I will stitch it up now. The salve will heal the wound swiftly." He smiled at her encouragingly as he prepared a needle and catgut. "You have been lucky,
and you have Tahi and Al-Salil to thank for that.
What will we do now, Dowie?
She held out one hand to Dorian. He took it and squeezed it. I can never go back into the Zenana.
She looked like the little monkey-faced girl again, pale and huddled in the shawl, bedraggled wet hair hanging limply over her shoulders, eyes underlined with purple shadows of pain.
You are never going back into the Zenana again. I give you my oath on it. Dorian leaned across and kissed her bruised, swollen lips. Then he stood up and his expression turned grim.
I must leave you here with Ben Abram while he finishes his work, he said. I also have work to do, but I will return very soon before Ben Abram is done. Be brave, my love.
He strode back through the trees, jumped down into the saucer, and went along the tunnel under the walls of the Zenana. He climbed out cautiously onto the terrace of the saint's tomb and took a minute to listen and watch. All was deathly quiet, so he dropped down the stairs and crossed the lawns. He paused behind the thorn hedge of the graveyard and satisfied himself that the corpses of the eunuchs had not been discovered or the alarm raised. Then he went forward cautiously. At the door of the hut he paused to allow his eyes to adjust to the gloom after the strong sunlight. Kush was curled up on the floor in the position of an unborn child in the womb. His bloody hands were still clutching his open stomach, and his eyes were closed. Dorian thought he was dead, but as he stepped up to the eunuch, he opened his eyes. His expression changed.
"Please, help old Kush," he muttered. "You were always a good boy, Al-Amkhara. You would not let me die."
Dorian stooped and picked up his sword from the floor. Kush became more animated.
"No, don't kill me. In the name of Allah, I beg you for mercy."
Dorian slid the blade into the scabbard on his belt, and Kush whimpered with relief.
"I said you were a good boy. Help me onto the litter."
He tried to crawl towards the bier that he would have used to take Yasmini to her grave, but the movement opened the great wound in his belly. Fresh blood trickled out, and he subsided again, clutching himself.
"Help me, Al-Amkhara. Call others to help carry me to a surgeon."
Dorian's expression was merciless as he stooped and seized Kush's ankles, then leaned back and dragged him across the floor towards the door.
"No, don't do that. You will open the wound further,"
Kush squealed, but Dorian ignored his protests. There was a long, slippery mark of blood and gastric juices on the flags behind Kush. Dorian hauled him feet first through the doorway into the sunlight. Kush moaned and grabbed the jamb of the door, hanging onto it with the strength of a drowning man. Dorian dropped his legs, and in one movement, almost too swift for the eye to follow, he drew and swung his scimitar, lopping off the three fingers of Kush's right hand that were clawed around the doorpost. Kush howled and held his mutilated hand to his chest. He stared down at it in horrified astonishment.
You have maimed me," he stuttered.
Dorian sheathed the sword, seized the eunuch's ankles again, and dragged him through the dirt of the cemetery towards the open grave. They had covered half the short distance before Kush realized what he intended. Now his screams were high and girlish, and he rolled and struggled so that his dangling entrails flapped and twisted in the sand. "The woman listening to your caterwauling will think your foul packets have burst inside Yasmini's belly," Dorian grunted. "Sing on, you great bag of pig fat. There is no one to help you now, this side of the devil in hell." With one last heave, he tipped Kush into the grave on top of the other two bodies and looked down at him, standing with both hands on his hips while he recovered his breath and waited for the pain in his broken ribs to subside a little. Kush read his own death in those green eyes.
"Mercy!"
he tried to rise. But the agony in his guts was too great, and he drew up his knees to his chest and huddled against the sidewall of the new-cut earth. Dorian went back and fetched the spade. When he returned and took up the first spadeful of earth, Kush screamed,
"No! No! How can you do this thing to me?"
as easily as you performed your unspeakable cruelties upon the defenceless women in your charge, Dorian replied. Kush screamed and pleaded until the earth smothered his cries. Dorian worked on doggedly, until the grave was filled in over the three bodies. Then he stamped it down and shaped the mound neatly. From the hut he fetched the headboard with Yasmini's name carved on it, and planted it on the mound. He tied a burial ribbon around it with the prayer for the dead embroidered on it. Then he replaced the spade in the hut, gathered up the pieces of severed leather thongs, and took down Kush's robes from where the eunuch had hung them on a peg in the wall. He rolled them into a bundle and tied it with a length of leather thong. Before he left the room, he glanced around to make certain that all was in order, and smiled grimly. For the next 100 years, the poets will sing of the disappearance of the three eunuchs after they had murdered and buried the lovely Princess Yasmini. Perhaps the devil himself came to escort them down to hell. Nobody will ever know. But what a fine legend it will make for posterity. Then he left the Zenana for the last time along the Angel's Road. When Dorian returned to where he had left them, Ben Abraham had finished stitching Yasmini's injuries and was binding them up with a wad of cotton. It is well done, Al-Salil, he assured Dorian. 7 days from now I will remove the stitches, and within a month she will be completely healed, as though it never happened. Dorian wrapped Yasmini in Kush's soft robes of finest wool, then helped her gently onto the stallion's back, holding her across his lap so there was no pressure on her wounds. They started back at a sedate pace towards the fort. She was so completely swathed in the voluminous robes that no inquisitive person they passed on the road would be able to tell if she were man or woman. "No one outside the Zenana has ever seen your face before. They will never recognize you as the Princess Yasmini, for she lies under her headboard in the graveyard of the Zenana." "Am I really free, Dowie?" she whispered with difficulty, for despite his care the stitches were pulling painfully. "No, you silly little baggage. You are now the slave boy who belongs to the great Sheikh Al-Salil. You will never be free." "Never?" she asked. "Promise me that I will be your slave forever, that you will never let me go." "I swear it to you." "Then I am well content." She laid her head on his shoulder. For many weeks thereafter, strange rumours were whispered in the souks of Lamu about the disappearance of Kush the eunuch. He had been well known in the islands, feared and hated even outside the walls of the Zenana. Some said that while walking on the road by night, he had been taken by the forest jinns. In another version of the same story, the abductor was Shaitan himself. The more pragmatic believed he had stolen from his master, Caliph al-Malik, and that, fearful of discovery and retribution, the eunuch had hired a dhow to take him across the channel and had fled into the interior of Africa. To give substance to this story, the Sheikh al-Salil issued a warrant for the arrest of Kush and offered a reward of 10,000 rupees for his capture. After a month or so, when nothing further was heard of the eunuch, the idlers in the souks lost interest in the case. The new topic of discussion on the island became the cessation of the Kaskazi winds, the beginning of the Kuzi, and the opening of a new trading season. Also, the imminent departure of the expeditionary army of Sheikh al-Salil for the mainland diverted interest from three missing eunuchs. Among the Sheikh's large retinue, few took much notice of the new slave boy Yasi. Though the lad was remarkably pretty and graceful of body, even in his ankle-length robes, at first he seemed in ill health, shy and uncertain of himself. However, the servant woman Tahi, the childhood nurse of the Sheikh and herself a newcomer to the household, took the boy under her protection. Yasi shared her quarters, and soon his beauty and pleasant ways won over all the other servants and slaves. Yasi had a trilling, unbroken voice and played the sistrum with rare skill. When Sheikh al-Salil sent for him every evening to sing to him in his private chambers, soothing away the worries and cares of the day, none of the household thought it strange. Within weeks, Yasi had obviously found special favour with his master and was made one of the Sheikh's body servants. Then the sheikh ordered Yasi to spread his sleeping mat in the tiny curtained alcove of his sleeping chamber, within easy call of Al-Salil's own bed, so that he could minister to his needs during the night. On the first night of this new arrangement, Al-Salil returned late from the war council with his Dao captains on the terrace. Yasi had been dozing while he waited for him, and sprang to his feet as Al-Salil entered the chamber, attended by Batula. Yasi had pitchers of hot water ready on the brazier, and after Batula helped the sheikh strip down to his loincloth, Yasi poured the water over Al-Salil's head and body so that he could bathe. In the meantime, Batula hung his master's weapons on the pegs beside his bed, sword and dagger honed, shield burnished, then came to kneel for his master's pleasure. "You may leave me now, Batula, but wake me in the hour before dawn, for there remains much still to be done before we sail." As he spoke, Al-Salil dried himself on the cloth Yasi handed him. "Sleep well, Batula, and may the eyes of God watch over your slumbers." The moment the curtains fell over the doorway behind Batula, Dorian and Yasmini grinned at each other, and he reached out for her. "I have waited too long," he said, but she danced back out of reach. "I have my duties to complete, noble master. I must dress your hair and oil your body." She knelt behind him while he sat on a silk rug, and with a cloth she rubbed his hair until it was almost dry, then combed it out and plaited it into a single thick braid down his naked back. While she worked, she gave small murmurs of admiration and awe. So thick and beautiful, the colour of gold and saffron. Then she massaged his shoulders with perfumed coconut oil and touched the scars on his body. Where did this happen? At a place called the Pass of the Bright Gazelle. His eyes were closed, and he submitted to the skilful touch of her fingers, for in the Zanana she had been taught the arts of pleasing a future husband. When he was lulled and almost asleep, she leaned forward. "Are you still so ticklish here, Dowie?" And she thrust her tongue deep into his ear. It galvanized him, and he gasped in protest. Goose pimples rose on his muscled forearms, and he reached back and grabbed her around the waist. "You must be taught more respect, slave." He carried her to the bed, dropped her on it, and knelt astride her, pinning her arms above her head. For a while they laughed into each other's face, and then the laughter stopped. He bent his head and laid his mouth on hers. Her lips opened warm and wet to receive him, and she whispered into his mouth, "I did not know that my heart could hold so much love." "Thou hast too many clothes," he murmured. And swiftly she wriggled out of them, arching her back to let him draw them out from under her and throw them onto the floor. "Thou art beautiful beyond the telling of it," he said, considering the silky golden length of her. "But is thy body healed?"
"It is, completely. But do not take my word for it, master. Prove it to thine own satisfaction, and to mine."
When the Koozie wind blew steady and strong down the channel, and the skies were burning blue, devoid of thunderheads, the flotilla of Sheikh Al-Salil sailed from Lamu, and 3 days later made its landfall on the African mainland. Under the waving silk of the blue banner they disembarked, and the long lines of armed men and draft animals wound away from the fever coast, marching inland along the slave road into the interior. The Sheikh rode in the van, and close behind him followed the slave boy, Yasi. Some of the men remarked on the adoration and hero worship with which the lad looked at his master and smiled indulgently. For the long months after their escape from Zanzibar, Tom Courtney explored the coast of the mainland. He kept well south of the Arab trade routes, avoiding any encounter with the Omani, either on land or sea. They were looking for the river mouth that Fundi, the elephant hunter, called the Lunga. Without the little man's help, they might never have found the entrance, for the channel doubled back upon itself, forming an optical illusion, so that from the sea the land seemed unbroken, and a ship might sail past without suspecting the existence of the river mouth. Once the little vessel was safely into the channel, Tom launched the two longboats. In them he sent Luke Jarvis and Alf Wilson to follow the main channel and guide the Swallow through. There were many false channels and dead ends among the papyrus beds, but they threaded their way along them. Many a time they were forced to turn back when the channel they were following pinched out. It took them days of searching and grueling labour to warp the Swallow through, and Tom gave thanks for her shallow draught. Without it they would never have been able to cross the numerous sandbars and shallows. Eventually they came out into the main flow of the river. The papyrus beds were infested by villainous-looking crocodiles and grunting, bellowing river horses. Over them hung a canopy of swarming insects. Vast flocks of shrieking, bleating wildfowl rose from the reeds as they passed. Abruptly the reed beds fell away, and they sailed through stretches of meadow-like floodplains and stands of open forest on either bank. Here, herds of strange animals lifted their heads from grazing and watched the little vessels pass, then snorted with alarm and stampeded away into the forest. Their numbers and variety were bewildering, and the sailors crowded the ship's rail to stare and marvel at them. There were graceful antelope, some the size of English red deer, others much larger, with strange, fantastic horns, scimitar-shaped, or lunate, or corkscrewed, not antlered like the deer they knew from home. Each day they went ashore to hunt these animals. The game was confiding, obviously never having seen white men with firearms, so that the hunters were able to approach within easy musket shot and bring them down with a well-placed lead ball. They never lacked for meat, and they pickled and dried what they could not eat immediately. Once they had butchered the kill, gutting and quartering the carcasses, even stranger creatures came to scavenge the bones and offal they left on the river bank. The first to arrive were carrion birds, undertaker storks and vultures of half a dozen species, which filled the sky above with a dark revolving cloud, then swooped in to settle. Graceful and majestic in flight, they were grotesque and gruesome in repose. After the birds came spotted dog-like creatures that whooped and wailed like banshees, and little red foxes with black backs and silver flanks. Then they saw the first lions. Tom did not need Aberley to tell him what these great maned cats were. He recognised them from the coats of arms of kings and noblemen in England, and from the illustrations in 100 books in the library at High Weald. The roaring and monstrous grunting of these beasts in the night thrilled the men as they swung in their hammocks, and Sarah crept closer into Tom's arms in the narrow bunk in their little cabin. In the forests and glades they searched for sign of elephant, their intended quarry, whose tusks would repay them for all this effort and endeavour. Fundy and Aberley pointed out great pad marks, moulded rock hard in the sun-baked clay. "These were made last season in the big wet," they told Tom. Then they came across trees in the forest that had been cast down as though by a mighty wind, stripped of their topmost branches and bark. But the trees were dried out, and their injuries long ago withered.
"A year ago," said Fundy, "their heads have gone on and might not return for many seasons."
The land became hilly, and the Lunga River twisted through the valleys, becoming swifter, floored with rapids. Soon they could force their way through only with difficulty, for boulders and sharp black rocks guarded the channel, and each mile they went put the little Swallow in deeper peril. In the end there was a place where the river formed an oxbow around a low forested hill. Tom and Sarah went ashore and climbed to the top. They sat together on the brow, and Tom surveyed the land below them through his telescope. "It's a natural fortress," he said at last. "We are surrounded on three sides by the river. We need only build a palisade across the narrow neck, and we will be secure from man and animal." Then he turned and pointed out a small bay with smooth rock sides. "There is a perfect mooring for the Swallow." "What will we do here?" Sarah asked, "for there are still no elephants." "This will be our base camp," he explained. "From here we can press on into the interior by longboat or on foot until we find the herds that Fundy has promised us." They built a palisade of heavy logs across the neck of the oxbow. They took ashore the cannon from the Swallow and mounted them in earthen emplacements to cover the glacis in front of the palisade. Then they constructed wooden huts and plastered the walls with mud, and thatched them with reeds from the riverbank. Dr. Reynolds set up his clinic in one of the huts and laid out his surgical instruments and medicines. Each day he forced every member of the party to swallow a spoonful of the bitter grey quinine powder he had purchased in the markets of Zanzibar, and though the drug made their ears sing, and they protested and cursed him for it, there was no fever in the camp. Sarah became his willing apprentice, and soon she could stitch up the gash in a foot caused by a carelessly swung axe, or administer a purge or bleed a sick man with as much aplomb as her teacher. Sarah chose the site for their living hut at a discreet distance from the others. It had a fine view over the river valley to blue mountains in the distance. She used cotton cloth from the bolts of trade goods to sew curtains and bedclothes. Then she designed the furniture and had the ship's carpenters build it for her. Ned Tyler had a farmer's instincts, and to augment the diet of venison and biscuit, he started a vegetable garden with seeds he had brought from England. He watered them through irrigation ditches he had dug on the riverbank. Then he fought a never-ending war with the monkeys and apes that came to raid the green sprouts as they pushed out through the soil. Within a few months the camp was complete, and Sarah named it Fort Providence. A week later, Tom loaded the longboats with trade goods, powder, muskets, and shot. With Fundy to guide them, he set out on a hunting and exploring expedition further upstream in search of the elusive elephant herds and of the native tribes with whom they could open trade. Ned Tyler was left with 5 men in charge of Fort Providence. Sarah remained with Ned also, for Tom would not allow her to make the journey upstream until he knew what dangers lay ahead. She would take over Dr. Reynolds's duties from him in his absence, and she had plans to continue her home-building work. She stood on the landing and waved to Tom until the longboats disappeared around the next bend in the river. 3 days' travel beyond the fort, the longboats moored for the night at a confluence with a smaller stream, while they gathered firewood and built shelters of thorn branches to keep out nocturnal predators. Fundy and Abuli scouted the banks of the stream. They'd been gone only for a short time before Fundy came scurrying back through the trees. His eyes were dancing with excitement as he poured out a flood of gabbled explanation. When he came to the end, Tom had understood only a few words. He had to wait for Abuli to come into the camp to hear the full report. "Fresh sign," Abuli told him. "A day old. A big head. Maybe 100. And a few big bulls with them. We must follow them at once." Tom was more excited than the little hunter, but Abuli pointed to the sun, which stood only a finger's width above the treetops. "It will be dark before we have gone a mile. We will start at first light in the morning. Such a head will be easy to follow. They are moving slowly, feeding as they go, and they will leave a road through the forest." Before darkness fell, Tom had planned the expedition. There would be 4 musketeers to attack the great beasts, himself and Abuli, Alf Wilson and Luke Jarvis. Each hunter would have 2 men to carry the spare guns, to reload and to hand him a freshly charged musket after each discharge. Tom checked the weapons himself. They were the rifled muskets that he had purchased in London. He made certain there were spare flints for the locks, that the powder flasks were filled and the bullet bags bulged with antimony-hardened lead balls for the 10-bore firearms. 10-bore signified that 10 of the lead balls it threw weighed 1 pound. While he worked on the weapons, Abuli filled the water skins and made certain they had biscuit and dried meat for a 3-day journey. Even after the long day of rowing and dragging the boats through the shallows, everyone in the party was too excited to sleep. They sat late around the fires, listening to the strange sounds of the African night, the whistle and hoot of the night birds, the idiotic giggling of the hyena and the rumbling roars of a pride of lions hunting the far hills. Often, in the short time he had been with them, Tom had listened to the stories of Fundy as he told of the hunt for the mighty grey beasts. But he asked the little man to repeat them now. Abeli translated when Tom could not follow, but his own knowledge of the Lhotse language was burgeoning, and he could understand much of what Fundi said. Fundi explained again how the elephant had very poor eyesight, but possessed a sense of smell that could warn him of a hunter a mile or more upwind.
"He can suck up your scent out of the air and hold it in the bone cavities of his head. Run with it for a great distance and blow it through his trunk into the mouths of his companions."
"Into the mouths?" Tom questioned him avidly. "Not the nostrils?"
"The smell of the inzu is in the top lip," Fundi explained.
His name for the elephant denoted a wise old man, not an animal, and he used it with respect and affection, expressing the feeling of the true hunter for his quarry.
"There are pink buds in his mouth, like the flowers of the kigilia tree. With these he tastes the air."
With a stick, Fundi drew the outline of the beast in the dust, and they craned forward in the firelight to watch as he explained where a man must place his arrow to bring down one of the giants.
"Here."
He touched a spot behind the shoulder of his drawing.
"With great care not to strike the bones of the leg, which are like tree trunks.
Deep!
Drive the iron in deep, for the heart and the lungs are hidden behind skin this thick."
He showed the span of his thumb.
"And muscle and ribs."
He held out his arms.
"You must go in this deep to kill the inzu, the wise old grey man of the forest."
When Fundi stopped talking at last, Tom implored him to continue. But he stood up with dignity.
"It will be a long, weary way tomorrow, and it is time to rest now. I will teach you more when we are on the spoor."
Tom lay awake until the moon had almost completed its circuit of the heavens, excitement boiling in his blood. When he closed his eyes, the image of the quarry appeared in his imagination. He had never laid eyes on the living beast, but he had seen hundreds of their tusks piled in the markets of the Spice Islands, and he remembered again the mighty pair that his father had bought from Consul Grey in Zanzibar, which now stood in the library at High Weald. "I'll kill another beast like that one," he promised himself. And in the hour before dawn he fell into a sleep so deep and dark that Abeli had to shake him awake. Tom left two men to guard the longboats, and in the first chilly glimmer of dawn they struck out along the trail that the elephant herd had left down the river bank. As Abeli had told him, the sign was clear to read, and they moved forward steadily. As the light strengthened, they went faster, and the trees they passed were smashed and stripped of bark and branches. Huge piles of yellow dung littered the forest floor, and troops of monkeys and flocks of brown partridge-like wild birds were scratching in it for undigested seeds and fruits.
"Here," Abeli pointed to one of these piles, "this is the dropping of a very old bull, one that might carry heavy tusks. The ivory never stops growing until the beast dies."
"How do you tell his dung from that of a young animal?" Tom wanted to know.
"The old man cannot digest his food properly."
Abeli dug his toe into the pile.
"See, the twigs are still whole, and the leaves entire. Here are the nuts of the ivory palm, with half the flesh still on the pip."
Tom considered the first scrap he had been thrown of the lore of the hunt. In the late morning they reached the point where the herd had left the stream and turned west towards the hills. Here they crossed an area where the surface was of fine talc dust. In this medium the imprint of the elephant pads was so detailed that each crack and wrinkle was faithfully preserved.
"Here," Abeli pointed out a string of pad marks, "this is the spoor of the great bull. See the size of each footprint, the front foot round and the back foot more oval in shape."
Abeli placed his own arm beside one of the tracks, using its length from the tip of his finger to the elbow as a yardstick.
"So long means that he is a mighty bull. And see how his pads are worn smooth. He is of great age.
Unless his tusks are worn or broken, this will truly be an animal worthy of the chase."
They crossed the first line of hills, and in the lush valley beyond, Fundi and Abeli divined from the sign that the herd had fed and rested the previous night.
"We have gained many hours on them,"
Fundy exulted. They are not far ahead. But Tom was to learn that day that Fundy's idea of distance did not coincide with his own. By nightfall they were still on the herd's tracks, and Fundy was still assuring them that they were not far ahead. All the white men in the party were nearing exhaustion, for sailors are not accustomed to covering such distances on foot. They had hardly the will left to eat a biscuit and a stick of dried meat, to swallow a few mouthfuls of water from the skins before they fell asleep on the hard earth. The next morning, while it was still dark, they were away again after the herd. Before long it was clear from the sign that they had lost much of their gain of the previous day, for the herd had kept moving westward in the moonlight while they had slept. For most of the white men, the march became an endless torment of thirst, aching muscles, and blistered feet. Tom was still young and tough and eager enough to make light of the hardship, forging along behind the trackers with the heavy musket over his shoulders.
"Close! We are very close now," Fundy grinned with malicious glee, and the grueling miles dropped behind them.
By now the water skins were almost empty, and Tom had to warn the men with dire threats not to drink without permission. Tiny black flies swarmed around their heads and crawled into their ears, eyes, and nostrils. The sun beat down like a hammer on an anvil and reflected up from the stony ground. The hooked thorns clawed at their legs as they passed, ripping their clothing and leaving bloody lines on their skin. At last they found where the herd had stopped in a patch of dense forest, had spent many hours resting, dusting themselves, and breaking down branches before it drifted on again, and the hunters finally made a real gain upon it. Abelie pointed out to Tom how the dung that the herd was now dropping had not had time to dry, and when he thrust his finger into one pile, he could feel the residual body heat. Clouds of brightly coloured butterflies hovered over the warm turds to drink up the moisture. With renewed strength in their legs, they increased the pace and climbed another line of hills. On the rocky slopes grew strange trees with swollen trunks and crowns of leafless branches on their tops, 50 feet above the ground. At the base of one tree, huge furry seed pods were heaped. Abelie cracked one open. The black seeds inside were coated with a yellow, pithy layer.
"Suck the seeds," he said.
The pleasant, sour taste made their saliva flow again and relieved the burning thirst of the march. The line of hunters, burdened by their weapons and water skins, toiled on up the hill. Just below the crest, their heads went up. An awful sound came to them on the heated air, distant but stirring as the blast on a war trumpet. Though Tom had never heard the like before, he knew instinctively what it was. Quickly he ordered the column to halt below the crest of the hill. Most of the men collapsed thankfully in the shade. He, Abelie, and Fundy crept up to the skyline. They used a tree trunk to break their silhouette as they peered over into the valley beyond, and Tom's heart leapt against his ribs like a caged beast. Down the length of the valley below them was strung out a line of sparkling green pools, each surrounded by lush reed beds and spreading shade trees. The elephant herd was gathered around the pools, some of the huge animals standing in the shade, fanning themselves with their ears, which seemed to Tom as wide as the mainsail of the swallow. Others were standing on the yellow sandbanks that surrounded the pools, dipping their trunks into the green water and sucking up gargantuan draughts, then curling their trunks into their mouths and sending it hissing down their throats with the force of a ship's bilge pump. Younger animals crowded into the pools. Like rowdy children, they frolicked and splashed, beating the water white with their trunks, shaking their huge heads and flapping their ears. Their wet bodies were black and shining. Some lay flat, then rolled onto their sides, disappearing entirely below the surface, leaving only their trunks writhing above the surface like a sea serpent. Tom went down on one knee and raised his telescope to his eye. This first sighting of the legendary beasts was so far beyond anything he had imagined that he was lost in wonder. He delighted in every detail. One of the youngest calves, not much bigger than a large pig, but mischievous and bumptious, charged out of the water, and with swinging trunk and murderous trumpeting, chased the white egrets that were perched on the edge of the pool. The birds rose in a gratifying white cloud, and the small elephant swaggered back into the water, slipped almost immediately in the mud, and trapped itself under a submerged log. Its now terrified squeals brought every protective female within earshot, rushing to the rescue, convinced that the calf had been taken by a crocodile. It was dragged out of the water, its dignity destroyed, and it fled, chastened, to hide between the legs of its mother and suckle for comfort at the milk-swollen udders between her front legs. Tom laughed aloud. Then Abele touched his shoulder and pointed out a group of three huge animals that stood aloof from the raucous behaviour of the cows and calves. They were in a patch of dense bush on the far side of the water, standing shoulder to shoulder, ears flapping lazily. Occasionally, one picked up a load of dust in his trunk and dashed it over his head and back. Apart from that, they seemed to be sleeping on their feet. Through the lens, Tom studied this towering trio, which dwarfed every other animal in the herd. He examined the long ivory shafts they carried and saw at once that though they were all massive, the bull in the centre carried tusks that protruded beyond his lip almost the length of a boat's oar, and with a girth of Sarah's slim waist. He felt the pulse of his hunter's blood pound in his ears at each pump of his heart. This was the bull he had dreamed of, and his instinct was to seize the musket he had propped against the tree beside him and rush down to do battle with the giant. But Abele sensed his mood and laid a restraining hand on his shoulder. "These are sage and wary creatures," he warned Tom. "It will not be easy to come up to that bull down there. His females will guard and protect him. It will call for all our cunning and caution to outwit them." "Explain to me what we must do," said Tom. And Abele and Fundi lay on each side of him and planned the hunt. "The wind is the key," Abele told him. "We must always keep below the wind." "There is no wind," Tom said, and pointed to the leaves that hung lifelessly from the top branches of the trees in the heated noonday. "There is always wind," Abele contradicted him, and let a handful of dust trickle through his fingers. The fine golden motes floated in the sunlight, then drifted slowly away. Abele made a delicate gesture describing the movement down the valley. "When they are alarmed, they will always run with the wind in their faces. Then they will circle to come above the wind and take the scent." He made another gesture to illustrate this manoeuvre. "We will place Alf and Luke there and there." He pointed out the positions. "When they are in place, you and I will come down here." He pointed out the path of their stalk. "We will creep in close. When we fire, the bulls will be driven onto the others." Tom gestured for Alf and Luke to come up beside him on the ridge. Once they had recovered from their initial amazement at the first sight of the quarry, he gave them their orders, sending them to circle out behind the ridge and cross it a mile further down the valley where they would be out of sight and below the wind of the herd. It was almost an hour later that through the telescope he made out the two parties of hunters moving up the valley into the positions he had assigned them. It was good to have men under him who knew his mind and could carry out his orders so faithfully. Abele leading, they slipped quietly over the skyline, using the trees and scrub to screen their crossing. The great beasts were not so dim-sighted that they could not pick up alien movement. They crept down towards the pools with painstaking stealth, taking care not to run into one of the females scattered among the trees. Tom could barely credit how such a huge animal could become virtually invisible when it stood still among the thick bush, grey on grey, even its legs resembling the tree trunks. Slowly they closed in on the trio of bulls. Although they were still invisible, the hunters were guided by their deep rumblings. Tom whispered to Abele, "Is that the sound of their bellies?" Abele shook his head. "The old men are speaking to each other." Occasionally they saw a cloud of dust rise above the tops of the bush as one of the bulls dusted himself. It guided them through the thick undergrowth. Step by cautious step they went forward, once having to pull back and circle around a young cow and her nursing calf in the scrub between them and their quarry. At last, Fundy stopped them with a gesture of his pink palm, then pointed ahead. Tom went down on one knee and, looking below the hanging vines and branches, made out the massive grey forelegs of the nearest bull. The sweat of excitement was trickling into his eyes and stinging like seawater. He wiped it away with the bandana knotted around his throat and checked the lock and flint of his musket. Abele nodded at him, and he drew back the hammer to half-cock. They began to crawl forward. Slowly, more of the nearest beast came into view. The droop of his belly, the baggy grey skin hanging in folds around his knees. Then the lower curve of one thick yellow tusk. They crawled in closer still, and Tom saw that the tusk was stained with the juices of bark that the bull had stripped from the forest trees. Closer still, and he could see every crease and wrinkle in the skin, each wiry hair in the stubby tail. Tom looked at Abele and made the gesture of firing, but Abele shook his head vehemently and signed to him to move in closer still. The bull was rocking gently on his feet. And then, to Tom's amazement, something extraordinary began to issue from between its back legs. It was thicker than a man's thigh and seemed to extend endlessly until it was dangling almost to the ground. Tom had to make an effort to prevent himself laughing. Drowsy and contented, the old man was letting his member dangle out and engorge. Again, Tom glanced at Abele for instruction, and again Abele scowled and urged him forward. But at that moment the bull stepped back and reached up with his trunk to pluck a bunch of leaves from the branches above him. The movement revealed the other bull, which he had been screening with his bulk. Tom drew breath with a soft hiss as he saw how much larger was the old patriarch than his attendant. His enormous head was drooping, and his ears flapped gently. They were tattered and worn like the sails of a storm-battered ship. His small eyes were closed, the thick, pale lashes meshing, and the ooze from the gland behind his eye ran down his cheek in a long, damp smear. The bull's head was propped on his tusks. Tom marvelled at the length and girth of those ivory curves which reached down to the earth. They were so thick and heavy that there was hardly any taper from the lip to the blunt tip. He could see the bulge under the grey skin where a quarter of the length was buried in the skull. They must be an onerous burden for even such a mighty animal to carry through all the days of its life, he mused. Tom was so close now that he could clearly see a metallic blue fly settle on the bull's eyelashes. The elephant blinked to drive it away. At that moment Tom felt a light touch on his arm and turned his head slowly to see Abele nod at him. He turned back and focused his gaze on the outline of the bones of the bull's shoulder under the wrinkled, eroded skin. He picked out the exact spot Fundy had described to him, just behind the shoulder and two-thirds of the way down the mighty barrel of the chest. He raised the musket and slowly drew back the hammer to full cock, muffling the click of the mechanism with his hand. Looking down the long barrel, he saw that the muzzle was almost touching the bull's flank. There was no need to use the pip of the foresight. Gently he took up the pressure of the trigger, and the hammer dropped in a burst of blue-white sparks over the pan. There was that moment of delay that seemed as long as infinity, but was the smallest part of a second. Then the heavy weapon bellowed and pounded into his shoulder, knocking him back on his haunches and blinding him with a cloud of white powder smoke which obscured the body of the elephant. A moment after his shot, he heard Abele fire. All around him, the tranquil forest erupted in a rush of mighty bodies. Trumpeting and squealing, the herd plunged through the undergrowth, then trees swayed and crashed down under the onslaught. Tom dropped the heavy gun, reached back, seized the second musket from the man behind him, and sprang to his feet. He ran into the thick cloud of smoke. As he emerged on the far side, he saw the plunging hindquarters of the bull disappear as the scrub closed behind him. "Chase him!" Abele shouted at his shoulder, and they raced after the fleeing bull. All around they heard the cows and squealing calves crashing through the undergrowth. Thorns and branches tore at Tom, but he ignored the ripping of his clothing and the scratching at his skin and ran on along the pathway that the bull had riven through the scrub. He burst out onto the open bank of one of the pools, and the beast was 50 feet ahead of him, his ears spread and the curves of his tusks showing yellow on each side of his baggy hindquarters as he bore directly away from Tom at full run. His stubby tail tuft was held high, and Tom could see the knuckles of his spine running down the curve of his back to join the tail. He swung up the musket and fired at the spine. The bull dropped into a sitting position on his haunches and skidded down the bank. But the ball must have grazed the spine rather than smashed it. He was paralyzed for but a second. As he reached the bottom of the bank, he came up on all four legs again and splashed through the head of the pool and up the far bank. Aboli ran alongside Tom and fired across the pool. They both saw the bull raise a puff of dried mud from the back of the bull's skull, but he shook his head, clapping his ears against his flanks, and disappeared into the dense bush on the far side. Tom grabbed his third musket from the panting sailor who handed it to him and plunged down the bank in pursuit of the bull. Aboli ran beside him, and they could see the course the bull was breaking through the forest. The treetops were shaking, and there was a rustling, crackling wake through the bush, like that of a breaching whale beneath the surface of the sea. Suddenly there was a thudding outburst of musket fire out on the right flank where the other hunters were hidden, and Aboli grunted, "The other bulls have run into Alf and Luke." Running together, they skirted the edge of the pool and plunged into the bush on the far side. The path the bull had torn through was closing behind him, and they struggled on with difficulty, losing cloth and skin to the thorns. "Oh, we'll never catch him now," Tom gasped. "He will run clear away from us." But when they burst out into a clearing at last, they both shouted with triumph as they saw the great bull only a pistol shot ahead. He was hard hit. His run had been reduced to an unsteady walk, and his head was hanging, his tusks ploughing long furrows in the soft earth, and pale, frothy blood was bubbling from the tip of his trunk. "Eh, your first shot was a lung hit," Aboli shouted, and they ran forward with renewed vigour, swiftly overhauling the wounded beast. 10 paces behind him, Tom dropped on one knee. He was gasping for air, his heart pounding and his hands shaking as he tried to take a bead on the swaying hindquarters, aiming once again for the spine. He fired, and this time the ball flew true from the rifled barrel. In the instant before the smoke obscured his vision, he saw it plough into the wide grey back, shattering the vertebra above the tail. The bull dropped onto its haunches once again. Tom scrambled to his feet and ran out to one side so that he could see around the smoke bank. The elephant was sitting facing him, shaking its head with fury and agony, the great tusks held high, blowing a carmine cloud of blood from the tip of its trunk. Its death squeals seemed loud enough to split Tom's skull and burst his eardrums. Aboli fired at the head, and though they both saw the ball struck the domed forehead, it could not penetrate the fortress of bone in which the brain was buried. The maimed beast tried to drag its crippled back legs behind it and reach its tormentors. Both men ran back, well out of reach of the swinging trunk, and with unsteady hands poured powder into the muzzles of their muskets, rodded down the wadding and the balls, then crept forward, circling to find an opening, to get in close before firing into the barrel of the chest. Again and again they ran back to reload, then came forward to fire. Gradually the strength of the beast leaked out of him from the mouths of 20 running wounds, and with a last groan he fell over on his side, stretched out those fabulous tusks, and was still. Tom went forward cautiously. He reached out with the muzzle of the musket, touching the tiny eye, fringed with pale lashes and brimming with almost human tears. It did not blink. The bull was dead at last. He wanted to shout his triumph, but instead he found himself overwhelmed by a strange, almost religious melancholy. Aboli came to stand beside him, And when their eyes met, Aberle nodded in understanding.
Yes, he said softly. You have learned what it means to be a true hunter. For you have understood the beauty and the tragedy of what we do.
Between them, Alf and Luke had brought down one of the other bulls, but the third had escaped the ambush and had run off unscathed with the rest of the herd into the forest. Tom wanted to follow him, but both Fundy and Abuli laughed at him.
You will never see him again. He will run for 20 miles without stopping, and then he will walk another 50 miles faster than you could run.
That evening they dined like princes on tough, rank elephant cheek meat, roasted on green stick skewers over the coals, and drank the muddy pool water tainted with elephant urine, as though it were the finest claret. They slept like dead men beside the fire. Over the next 2 days they drew the tusks from the two bulls, chopping them out of the skull, taking infinite pains not to mark or mar the ivory. Fundy showed them how to free the long conical nerve from the cavity in the butt of each tusk and stuff the hole with green grass. Then they used bark rope to secure the four huge tusks to carrying poles. When they set out on the long march back to where they had left the boats, it took 4 men to carry each tusk. When they reached the river again, they cached the tusks on the bank, burying them so deep that even the hyena could not dig them out and chew them to splinters. Then they went on upstream in the longboats. Each day they found fresh elephant sign, more plentiful, and they followed on foot, sometimes killing within a few miles. At other times they were forced to march for days to catch up with the herds. Within a month they had harvested enough ivory to make a full load for both longboats. All the white men were ragged and exhausted. The fat had been burned off them. Their bearded faces were gaunt and their bodies skeletal. Only Aberle and Fundy seemed unaffected by the hardships of the hunt. There was general rejoicing when Tom announced his decision to turn back to Fort Providence. That night at the campfire, Aberle and Fundy came to where Tom sat, staring into the dying flames, thinking of Sarah, anticipating their reunion. They squatted on each side of him, and he considered their dark faces thoughtfully before he spoke. "This is grave business," he said with certainty. "I can see that you mean to spoil my contentment and my pleasure at the return to Fort Providence." He sighed with resignation. "Very well. What is it?"
"Ufundi says that we are very close to the lands of his people, the Lhotse."
"How close?" Tom asked suspiciously. By now he spoke the Lhotse language with confidence, and he had learned what Fundy considered very close.
10 days' travel, Fundy said confidently.
But when Tom stared at him accusingly, he dropped his eyes.
"Or perhaps a very little further," he admitted.
"So Fundy wishes to return to his own people?" Tom asked.
"And I will go with him," said Aberle quietly.
Tom felt a stab of alarm. He stood up and led Aberle out of the firelight, then turned on him almost angrily.
"What is this?" Tom asked. "Do you wish to leave me and go back to Africa?"
Aberle smiled.
"I leave you only for a while. You and I have become branch and vine of the same tree. We can never be put asunder."
"Then why do you go without me?"
"For many years the Lhotse have been hounded by the slavers. If they caught a glimpse of your white face..."
He shrugged expressively.
"No, I will go with Fundy. We will take trade goods with us, as much as we can carry. Fundy says that his tribe has a store of ivory from the elephant they have taken in their pitfalls and from the carcasses of those old animals they have found dead in the forest. With Fundy to calm their fears and with samples of our goods to show them, perhaps I can open up a road of trade with the Lhotse. How will I find you again?"
"I will come to you at Fort Providence. Fundy says that I can buy a canoe from his tribe. Perhaps my canoe will be loaded with riches when we meet again."
Aberle placed an avuncular hand on Tom's shoulder.
"You have shown that you are a mighty hunter in these last days. But now it is time for you to rest. Go back to the woman who waits for you and make her happy. I shall return before the season changes and the big wet begins.
The next morning, Abele and Fundi lifted the heavy bundles of trade beads, copper wire, and cloth onto their heads, balancing them easily so their hands were free to hold their weapons, and set off westward along the riverbank. Tom walked a little way beside Abele, then stopped and watched his old comrade disappear among the tall riverine forest trees before he turned away sadly and went down to where the longboats were loaded and moored against the bank.
"Shove off," he ordered, as he took his seat at the tiller of the leading boat. "Take us back to Fort Providence."
And they cheered him as they went to the oars and ran down with the current towards the east. The lookouts on the hill above Fort Providence spotted the longboats as soon as they rounded the last bend upstream, and Sarah was dancing with excitement on the beach when Tom stepped ashore. She rushed into his arms, but after the first embrace drew back and stared into his face, appalled by what she saw. "You're starved," she said, "and dressed like a scarecrow in rags." Then she wrinkled her nose. "When last did you bathe?" She led him up the hill, but would not let him into the little cottage. "You'll stink out all my hard work." First she filled the galvanized hip bath, which stood under the wild fig tree in the backyard, with steaming water. Then she undressed him, set aside his rags for later washing and mending, and sat him in the bath as though he were a little boy. She sponged away the accumulated dust and filth of the weeks of hard hunting, combed out his thick black hair and braided it into a sailor's pigtail. With her scissors she trimmed the shaggy bush of his beard into the neat, pointed style that King William had made fashionable. She anointed all the scratches and cuts that covered his legs and arms with a salve she fetched from Dr. Reynolds' surgery. Tom revelled in the attention. At last she helped him into fresh, lovingly ironed shirt and breeches. Only then did she take his hand and lead him into the cottage. Proudly she displayed everything she had done in his absence, from the easy chair that the carpenters had made, especially for him, to the broad double bed in the back room and the mattress she had sewn and filled with dried kapok from the silk cotton trees that grew along the river bank. Tom eyed the bed with a wicked grin. "It looks to be a fine piece of work, but I'd best test it before I give a firm opinion," he said, and chased her giggling twice around it before she allowed herself to be captured and lifted onto the embroidered covers. Afterwards they lay and talked while the sun set, and then long into the night. He told her of all he had done and seen. He described the hunting to her, and the new strange lands they had found, the forests and the far blue mountains, and the marvellous animals and birds they had discovered. "It's so big and endless and beautiful and wild," he told her, and held her close. "We never saw another man, nor any sign of anyone in all our journey. It's all ours, Sarah, ours for the taking." "Will you take me with you next time?" she asked, jealous of his attention, wanting to share the wonders of it all with him. Somehow she never doubted that there would be a next time. She saw that he had fallen in love with this land, as much as he was in love with her. She knew that from now on they were both a part of it. "Yes," he agreed. "Next time you shall be with me to see it." There was so much to tell and to discuss that it took more than one long night. Over the lazy weeks that followed, while the men rested and recuperated from the hunting, Tom and Sarah spent hours alone each day. He read to her from the journal he had kept during the expedition, so that he overlooked no detail, and when he had told it all to her, they discussed and planned the future. "We've been lucky to discover this Lunga River, or rather to have Fundi show it to us," Tom told her. "The old Portuguese explorers must have overlooked it, and the Arabs also. Fundi tells me that the Arab trading routes, the slave road, is a long way further to the north." He smiled ruefully. "If Fundi says it is a long way, you can believe it is 100 miles or more. With luck, neither the Omani nor John Company will ever find us here. Fort Providence is a perfect entrepot to the interior. The elephant herds hereabouts have never been hunted, and if Abele and Fundi can make contact with the tribes, we can open up trade with them and have it all to ourselves." "But where will you sell the ivory?" she asked. "Not in Zanzibar or any other Arab port, nor any place where the company has a factory. Brother Guy will never let you rest if he finds where you are. We can never go back to England. She tried not to sound wistful, and hurried on. Where can we sell our goods and buy the necessities? Powder and shot, medicines and flour, candles and oil, rope and canvas and pitch? There is such a place close at hand, Tom assured her. As soon as the long rains begin, the big wet, we will pull out of here and sail down to Good Hope. The Dutch at the Cape will be hot for our ivory, and even hotter to sell us all the goods we can pay for. Best of all, they won't give a brass guilder or a morsel of their old cheese for the warrant of arrest placed on me by the Lord Chancellor of England. There was much to keep every man in the fort busy during the weeks when they waited for Uberley to return. All the ivory had to be cleaned, weighed, and packed with dry grass to prevent it being damaged during the voyage. Then the little swallow had to be careened on the beach below the fort, her bottom scraped clean of weed. The shipworm that had taken hold in her planking had to be burned out with boiling pitch. Once she was afloat again, they repainted her, stitched the rents in her canvas, and made small changes to her rigging so that she would not be recognized as the ship in which they had escaped from England. It was a sailor's superstition that it was bad luck to change a ship's name, but there was no help for it. They scraped the old name from her transom and painted the new one over it. When they relaunched her, Sarah broke a bottle of brandy from the ship's stores over her bows. "I rename this ship Centaurus," she intoned. "May God bless her and all who sail in her." Then the ivory was taken aboard the Centaurus and carefully loaded into her holds. They refilled her water casks and made all ready for the voyage southwards. Now each afternoon the thunderheads began to build up along the northern horizon, mountains that reached up into the heavens. The sunset turned the cloud ranges purple and sullen scarlet, the lightning flickered in their bellies, and the far thunder muttered the threat of the coming wet season. The first rains burst upon them, sweeping across the hills in trailing robes of grey. For 3 days and nights thunder bombarded them, and the air was filled with water, as though they lay beneath a mighty waterfall. Then the storm clouds opened, and in that lull a dozen long dugout canoes came fast down the swollen waters of the Lunga River. In the lead canoe stood Uberley, tall and scar-faced. Tom shouted with joy and ran down to the beach to welcome him ashore. Fundy was in the last canoe, but the oarsmen were all strangers. The bottom of each craft was stacked with elephant tusks, none as large as those that Tom's expedition had taken, but valuable nonetheless. The oarsmen were all of the Lotsi tribe, kinsmen of Fundy. Despite his assurances, they were terrified of the strange white men of Fort Providence. They expected to be taken as slaves, chained together and marched away, as had happened to so many of their tribe. Gone. Never to be seen or heard of again. They were mostly old men, grey and bent, or uninitiated striplings. They huddled together on the beach, not to be reconciled or comforted by any of Tom's reassurances in Lotsi. "They have come with us only because Bongola, their chief, ordered them to do so," Uberley explained. "When he saw the trade goods we brought with us, his greed surpassed his fear of the slavers. Still, he would not come himself to trade, but sent the least important members of the tribe in his stead." They brought the ivory ashore from the canoes and weighed it, then discussed a fair price for it with Fundy. "I do not want to spoil the trade by overpaying them," Tom explained to Sarah, "but neither do I want to bilk them and kill the trade before it begins." In the end, the bags of Venetian trade beads, bolts of cloth, crates of hand mirrors and axe heads and bales of copper wire were loaded into the canoes and the rowers were sent home. Their little flotilla shot upstream against the current, propelled by men so thankful to have escaped with their lives that they rowed with the strength of demons, hysterically chanting their gratitude for their escape to their tribal gods and ancestors as they disappeared around the first bend. "They will be back next season," Uberley prophesied. "Bongola will see to that." Fundy and three of the bolder Lotsi, who had remained with him, agreed to stay on at Fort Providence during the big wet and protect the buildings and gardens against the ravages of the weather and wild animals. The rest of the party loaded the last of the ivory and went aboard the Centaurus. As the full onslaught of the rains washed over them, they let the swollen river and the monsoon wind drive the little Centaurus downstream and out into the ocean of the Indies. The course to clear Madagascar and make for Good Hope is southeast by south. Mark it on the traverse board, if you please, Mr. Tyler, Tom ordered.
Southeast by south it is, Cap'n.
Full and by, Mr. Tyler, said Tom, who took Sarah's hand and led her to the bows. They stood together and watched the flying fish explode from the surface of the Mozambique Channel and spin away in silvery blurs like new-minted coins tossed across the blue current. If I can find a priest at Good Hope,
will you marry me, Sarah Beatty? He asked.
That I will, Thomas Courtney. She laughed and hugged him closer.
That I will.
The little Centaurus anchored in Table Bay on a sunny morning in which the southeaster chopped bursts of white off the tops of the wavelets. They went ashore under the towering mountain whose flat top was covered by the famous tablecloth, a stationary bank of roiling white cloud. The settlement had grown in size since last they had visited the Cape. The strictures of the Dutch East India Company against foreigners owning land or taking up residence in its territory were every bit as draconian as those of its English counterpart. However, Tom soon discovered that for a few golden guilders placed in the hands of the right official, these laws could be waived. Once they had paid their dues, the welcome they received from the burghers was convivial, especially as the Centaurus was well burdened, and the Dutch merchants smelt profits in their visit. They planned to stay in the Cape until the rains on the fever coast had passed. As their quarters aboard the Centaurus were cramped and the motion of the ship at anchor was uncomfortable, Tom found lodgings for himself and Sarah in one of the little guest houses below the company gardens run by a manumitted Malay woman who was a wonderful cook and hostess. In the first week, Tom visited all the merchants whose warehouses lined the waterfront, and was delighted to find that the demand for ivory was strong. He struck several good bargains for the sale of their cargo. The crew were given their first pay and share of the profits since they had sailed from England. Over the next few months, most of them spent everything they had earned in the ale shops and bawdy houses of the town, but Ned Tyler and Dr. Reynolds used theirs to purchase small holdings of land in the Constantia Valley on the far side of the mountain. Tom and Aberley used nearly all of their share to buy the necessary stores for another season at Fort Providence, and a goodly stock of the trade goods on offer in the warehouses of the colony. Tom gave Sarah £50 from the prize, which she used to assemble her trousseau. It included a small harpsichord and a baby cradle on wooden rockers, which she painted with floral wreaths and choirs of cherubs. The entire crew were in the congregation of the little church in the gardens, when Tom and Sarah were married, and after the ceremony they carried the newlyweds on their shoulders down the street to their lodgings, singing all the way and pelting them with handfuls of rose petals. In one of the waterside taverns, Aberley found a sun-wizened little Dutchman named Andries van Houten, who had been brought out from Amsterdam as a gold finder for the Dutch East India Company.
"I have scoured the mountains as far as Stellenbosch," van Houten told Aberley, after the third tankard of ale had slid effortlessly down his gullet, his Adam's apple bobbing in his red wrinkled throat. "There is no gold in this devil-damned colony, but I can smell it in the north." He sniffed the air. "If only I could find the ship to take me up the coast." And he looked at Aberley hopefully. "But I don't have a guilder in my purse to pay my passage."
Aberley brought him to see Tom, and they talked every evening for a week. In the end, Tom agreed to purchase all the prospecting equipment that van Houten needed and take him to Fort Providence when they sailed. Those pleasant days at Good Hope passed too swiftly, and they were soon reloading the Centaurus, taking great care with Sarah's harpsichord and the cradle. As the season changed, and the oak trees that lined the streets dropped their leaves, they hoisted the anchor and sailed northwards around Cape Point and into the Mozambique Channel again. When they entered the mouth of the Lunga River and forged their way upstream, they saw the high water mark on the banks and the debris hanging in the branches of the trees that showed just how strong had been the flood during the months of the big wet. When they reached the hilly country, the forest was green and burgeoning with new growth. Faithful to the trust they had placed in him, Fundy met them at the landing below Fort Providence and proudly showed Tom how well he had cared for everything in their absence. They set to rethatching the roofs of the huts and repairing the weak spots in the palisade. Sarah had her new harpsichord installed in the front room of their cottage and played and sang for Tom every evening after dinner. She placed the painted baby cradle beside their bed in the back room. The first night, Tom eyed it as he sat on the bed and pulled off his boots. "I take that as a challenge, Mistress Courtney," he told her. "Shall we see what we can do about filling it?" They did not have much time to devote to the task, for within weeks Tom was ready to take the first hunting party upriver. Van Houten was in the leading boat, sitting on his wooden box of chemicals, with his gold pan stacked at hand. He prospected every gravel bed and sandbank they passed. When they went ashore to hunt the elephant herds, Van Houten did not join them, but wandered away with his two Lhotse helpers to search the hills and streams for traces of the precious metal. The hunting was good this season. Within a month they had filled the boats with ivory, and set out to retrace their steps to Fort Providence. Sarah accompanied Tom on the second expedition, bringing with her the paint box she had bought in Good Hope. She filled the pages of her sketchbooks with images of the journey. They followed the river further than ever before, and at last reached the country of the Lhotse. At the first village, the entire population fled into the forest, and it took several days before they came creeping out timidly from among the trees. After Fundy and Abeli had overcome their initial fear and suspicion, they began a friendly relationship with the tribe. They found that the Lhotse were generally a pleasant and cheerful people. Though small in stature, they were well-formed and handsome. Some of the women were beautiful, with fine Nilotic features. They went bare-breasted, and their carriage was graceful and proud. Abeli had a long, serious discussion with the village elders, and the outcome was that for a few rolls of copper wire and a small bag of glass beads, he acquired two of the prettiest, plumpest virgins as wives. The girls were named Fala and Zete. It was difficult to tell who was better pleased with the bargain, the bridegroom or the little brides, preening in the new finery Abeli had given them as part of the bride price, and gazing at their husband with awe and reverence. Dr. Reynolds, with Sarah to assist him, successfully treated many of the sick Lhotse, which sealed the good relations with the tribe. When the expedition went on upriver to the capital kraal of the Lhotse, the drums carried ahead of them the news of their coming. Their paramount chief, Bongola, came down to the landing to welcome them and lead them to the new huts that had been built especially in their honour. Bongola's village was a cluster of several hundred thatched huts built along the river bank and on the slopes of the hills. Each hut was set around with a shamba of mango and plantain trees and manioc plants. Kraals of logs housed the scrubby cattle and goats of the tribe and kept them safe from the nocturnal forays of leopard and hyena. By this time, Tom and Abeli were both fluent in the language, and they held long indabas with Bongola each day of their stay. Bongola was a naturally garrulous little man, and he related the recent history of the tribe to Tom. The Lhotse had once held rich lands on the banks of the great freshwater lake to the north, but then the slavers had arrived and fallen upon them like the cheetah on the gazelle herds of the plains. The survivors had fled southwards, and for almost two decades now had evaded further depredations. But each day they lived in terror of the slavers, whom they knew were slowly driving their raiding columns deeper into the interior. "We know that one day we will have to fly again," Bongola told Tom. "That was why we were filled with such alarm when we heard of your arrival." Tom remembered Abeli's stories of how he had been captured by the slavers when he was a child. He remembered also those unfortunates he had seen in the slave markets of Zanzibar, and felt once again that deep abhorrence of the trade and anger at his own inability to ease the plight of these people.